Good morning, all. I'm John Fox Sullivan with The Atlantic. This is going to be a fun session. Question, how many of you, and insightful, how many of you have actually been to China? Okay. There is no pressure on the two of you. I had the good fortune to go to China a couple of years ago for only 2 weeks. I am hardly a specialist, but was fascinated by it, came back, and now I live and die, breathe, whatever, on every word that Jim Fallows writes, because I find it so helpful to understand what's going on. We have two extraordinary folks here, Orville Schell, who is Mr. China, if you will, has been writing about it since the 60s. I'm sure you've read a number of his books. I love this. Orville, how many books have you written? Is it nine? He says, I don't know, it's nine or ten on China. I love the casualness of that. He's been dean of the School of Journalism at Berkeley for a long, long time, and has just recently taken over a program at the Asia Society in New York, running a new China program they have. So we're happy to have Orville here. Jim Fallows, all of you know, he's been a longtime writer and correspondent for The Atlantic for well over 20 years. Since I published The Atlantic, I got to brag what Jim has done in Atlantic during the last 3 or 4 years with regard to the Iraq War, 3 or 4 major pieces that he had, and then a book that he did. I think many of his colleagues in journalism think he's done the finest work on this particular subject, so I get to brag about him. Jim and his wife, Deb, have gone over, are now living in Shanghai. Some people like to cover, some people like to report. Jim immerses himself by literally moving to China with his family, with his wife. Deb is here somewhere. And they just got back 2 nights ago, and they're going to spend a year and a half or 2 years, and will be writing about their experience in virtually every issue of Atlantic. If you have not read this current issue, I really beg of you to do so. Why China's Rise is Good for Us by James Fallows, asterisk, except for the coming nuclear arms race. we also published another magazine, 02138, which is for and about Harvard graduates, and they're going to be doing this. There will be a piece coming out of this particular session for that magazine. So with that, let me just get off stage and turn it over.
Well, thanks, John. I know the spirit is strong and the flesh is weak, and you are all testament to the strength of the spirit by arriving here at 7:45 this morning, so thank you for coming. Well, Jim, one of the reasons I really enjoyed your writing on China is because I think even people who've spent a long time looking at China have just as many questions as people who spent a short time looking at China. And that's actually what makes it so interesting. So to watch you go through your peregrinations and try to come to terms with it, it's been really a pleasurable experience for me. But tell us a little bit about your calculation when you first decided, well, I think Deb and I are going to go to China. What was in your head, and what did you see about the story that made you think that you wanted to spend a couple of years chasing it?
There were some long wave theories of what we were doing and some shorter, more immediate theories. In the now, I guess, 25 plus years in which I've worked for The Atlantic, Deb and I have spent a little more than half the time in D.C. and half the time other places. You know, we've lived in that time in Tokyo and Kuala Lumpur and Texas and Seattle and Berkeley for a couple of years at a stint. And so we've been in D.C. for 5 years straight after moving back there on September 10th, 2001, and had been immersed in all the sort of ensuing events. So it was time to go someplace else. Also, I tried to place no emphasis on the fact that in the previous 149 years of its existence, The Atlantic had been based in Boston, and I had not, and suddenly The Atlantic moved to D.C., and I was living in the home office of the magazine, which was wonderful in most ways, but also I thought it was a good time to see the world as well. So we wanted to go someplace other than D.C. The reason for China in particular is that 20 years ago when we moved to Japan, we went to China a number of times. Our first visit in 1986 to Beijing and Shanghai was as delegates to the World Esperanto Congress. This is a long story, which I wrote about in the magazine, but we had seen it a fair amount in through the late 80s, but not since then.
Does it still continue the Esperanto Congress?
It does. The reason it was in China is that there are two great reservoirs of Esperanto speakers in the world. One is Bulgaria, and for reasons I don't really know, the other is China, where during the Cultural Revolution and afterwards, it was an acceptable international language to teach as opposed to English. And the most embittered people we saw on that trip in the 80s were the Chinese experts who'd been forced to take Esperanto and not English. And so this was their one ability to kind of put it into play. And as I pointed out in the Atlantic article, most of the discourse was in Esperanto, which we actually learned, and it's not that hard. But whenever there was an announcement of where the food was or when the plane left, it was in English, which was a sort of piquant and heartbreaking moment for the Esperantists. But to have a chance to see what China looked and felt like now from some kind of mild previous introduction, how it compared to places we knew better, especially Japan and Korea and Southeast Asia, that was the theme.
And how has it startled you? I mean, you've obviously been there before, but now you've been living there going on a year. What about it has really jumped out?
You know, it was actually from this event last year that we went directly to Shanghai. So although we spent maybe a quarter of the intervening year in other countries, like in India and in Thailand and other places in the vicinity, it's been a year since we left here. In the first month or two, there were things which were, we tried to dismiss the startling events of the cliched fashion. Gee whiz, there are all these skyscrapers in the Pudong side of Shanghai. I guess something which struck me initially related to our previous stay is how much more virulent anti-Japanese feeling was than 20 years earlier. You know, I was doing some courses at Fudan University, which is how I ended up getting a visa to go to China to be a lecturer there. And you have these 18-year-olds saying, we Chinese are students of history, therefore we hate Japan. And not so much, we Chinese are students of history, therefore we regret the Cultural Revolution, therefore X, Y, and Z, but it was therefore we hate Japan. That was probably the single thing which was startling on the conceptual realm. I guess in the day-by-day realm, as I'm sure anybody here who spent time in China recently knows, is the contrast between the things that are controlled and everything else. You know, the media are often controlled, and you'll see, you know, the news has a certain slant, and public gatherings are very kind of, you know, as you know, very controlled by the authorities, and the rest of life just seems to be out of control. You know, there's not enough police to control things. People do whatever they want in good ways, bad ways. Well, you are Mr. China, thanks to John Sullivan, my Mr. China, who I talk about in this article. He's built this huge empire in Shenzhen, in southern China. He says he's never talked to the local officials there. That's been entirely just setting up businesses. And you know, this came up where I asked him, who should I talk to in the Shenzhen party leadership or the provincial officials? He'll say, how did this industrial empire grow? And he said, he didn't really know because he hadn't met these guys. So the contrast between in control and out of control has been very interesting for us.
There is a kind of I don't think the world has experienced quite such a period of hyper growth. There's an almost a mutant quality often. And I wonder, as you watch it, do you feel that this is sustainable? I mean, what's your analysis of the foundation of this whole enterprise?
Here we come to a subject I think you and I did discuss a year ago, which is the catalog of questions that the mic is not working. So I will talk more loudly. Maybe the microphone is the microphone working now? I'll both project in case it were not working. There is a whole catalog of questions that in a way resemble the questions we talk about in the U.S. for the next year of who's going to be the next president. Which is that fascinating to discuss, and nobody can tell the answer at all. And the sustainability of the economy is clearly one of those, because we can all tick off the 16 different limits they're about to encounter. Number one, environmental, which is the overwhelming disaster and feature of our lives every single day, or the rich-poor gap, or resource gaps, or trade frictions with the U.S., or whatever. I guess my sense is that, you know, it's like somebody falling off a building and you don't know how many stories. You know, so far it's been okay. So far the image.
That's a terrible analogy.
Well, yeah. I was about to elaborate it. Okay. I was going to use some kind of Einstein reference. So just give me a chance here. To use a different analogy, we often think of a boat going down a river full of big boulders. And so far, just before hitting each boulder, they've moved away. And you can see another big set of big boulders, and will they keep moving away? You will see, but so far for 20 years they've done it. The building analogy is, suppose in some Einsteinian parallel universe you had a hole all the way through the center of the Earth or something, so they would fall down at a building in that hole, maybe like an ice cream stick on which the Earth rotates. So it would fall but never really hit anything. It sort of yo-yo up and down inside the core of the Earth. I know, so they're falling, so far so good, who knows where they will hit.
That sounds like a pretty high-risk analogy.
Well, this is happening in real time early in the morning, so.
I mean, one interesting question about China today is here's a country which for the last several millennia put incredible emphasis on history, turning backwards always for examples of how to to find exemplars and to kind of see how to be in the present. And yet now we find a tremendously ahistorical country. And I'm wondering, as you talk to people and move around, how do you assess China's ability, or perhaps the advisability, of forgetting the past?
This also is a really intriguing and deep question, which you have written about a lot recently. And I was just thinking back for a second to what you said about things that were initially surprising, and let me segue through that to what you're asking now. Another thing which was initially surprising is how, for a country so materially rich in a number of ways, and not always, there still is a kind of peasant behavior by a lot of urban people. You know, the defamed behavior in line, the famed spitting, the sense of, you know, rural people suddenly in the big city and taking a while to get polished up is one of those. But I think in trying to explain the somewhat abrasive public manners in China, which are a real factor in which they're trying to clean up before the Olympics to avoid embarrassment. You know, as you think of, all of you probably know about Stand in Line Day. The 11th of each month in Beijing is the day you stand in line to get you in practice. I don't know if they're going to build up to 2 or 3 days per month by the Olympics, but it's started about three months ago. June 1st was No Honking Your Horn Day in Shanghai, and that seems to have worked, you know, for who can explain. But you know, in looking for the sources of why public manners are so abrasive, one hypothesis would be that the Cultural Revolution era took away everything that would moderate people's sort of seemly behavior in public, of people mistrusting their parents, abusing their parents, mistrusting everyone, having a year zero sense of history, and having essentially no religion. And it's interesting to me that the most senior party officials I've interviewed have talked about religion much more than about democracy as something which is, they've been talking about Buddhism, but talking about something to inculcate some values. And I should ask you, one hypothesis is before the Cultural Revolution, people had some kind of manners to each other. Is that a true or a false hypothesis or explanation?
Well, I think at some point before, I mean, the whole Confucian sort of construct and Confucian value system was very operable. In fact, that's partially what propelled the revolution to resist it, to break free from that gravity. And I guess, you know, they did a very good job of that. I think the cost was high. But in a curious way, let me throw it back to you with sort of the other end of that question. If we look at the Cultural Revolution and the whole Maoist revolution as a kind of an exercise in demolition, do you think that that in some way was an essential antecedent to be able to build the kind of amazing structure, a little bit like Europe after the Second World War? It was bombed to the ground and then it just got built up again in this new way. It didn't have to deal with the past.
That would be an argument. You can use the case I know better, actually, about Japan, where World War II and the occupation left many things intact, you know, more intact than the U.S. authorities had any idea, you know, where they were sort of bringing a lot of the old bureaucracy right back in place.
But and the emperor.
And the emperor, of course. But because they were able to change things in the land system in particular and a few other areas, they were able to have some of the dynamism for Japan's post-war rise. I suppose you could argue that the clearing away of a lot of impedimenta and, you know, ranging from, you know, role of women to whatever else during the Cultural Revolution years did make some things possible, like the huge boom in southern China. I guess the question then is, was there some other way to do the clearing exercise? Because this seemed like a fairly brutal fashion, which, as you know, too, is, in my mind, the hardest thing to get people to talk about, is the Cultural Revolution or Maoist years. And just, there's no sort of safe way for people to come out with a discussion of this topic. And so we find when we are individually, by we, I mean, you know, often Deb and me meeting people socially, if it's an individual Chinese person, we can get their story about the Cultural Revolution years, but in two or threes, it's very difficult to do.
I mean, in the Western scheme of things, and I, in the case of Germany, there's very much the presumption that the past inevitably weighs heavily on the present, and unless you deal with the past, you can't actually come into the present in a healthy and constructive way. And yet, every Chinese has some extraordinary nightmare, and it isn't really talked about, and in fact, the presumption of the whole economic boom almost seems to be, let's pretend it didn't happen. And is that viable?
No, and that's, you know, I don't know, but it is striking, and I'm thinking of, you know, is very, very often the leitmotif in conversations with people in China to say, well, we are a 5,000-year-old nation, we have this and that influence, and then the next part of the sentence will be, and of course we were for a long time the strongest nation on earth, and that will naturally return, or, you know, our leading city, you know, Hangzhou was famous as a beautiful city, and so we should think it's beautiful now, even though it's covered with smog, or this is why we have good relations with the Americans because of our alliance in World War II, et cetera, et cetera. But the sentence never leads to the conclusion, and that's why the 1960s were such a disaster, because I at least have never heard someone volunteer that. You know, it can be extracted but not volunteered, so that is a difficult, we'll see whether that great huge donut in the otherwise consistent theme of historical connection, whether that, what that means in the long run, I don't know now.
I mean, I think you sort of have to wonder as you look at China today, and if you experience the past at all, what happened to it, and what can a society, can a culture do with history that doesn't fit into the present scheme of things?
You know, here's a really lowbrow answer to that. One of the most interesting places we saw in Shanghai is the Propaganda Poster Museum. I don't know how many of you have been there. It's in this really hard to find. It's like in the sort of the superintendent's office room in some big New York apartment building. You have to go around the corner and down some stairs. But somebody has made a collection of hundreds of the Red Guard posters and post-war posters too, and they are really, really fascinating. And so that's one place where I've seen people trying to integrate the extremes of that time. I've spent a lot of time with university students, and some high school students too. High school students simply are not given any info about this whole era, and university students, by extension, don't have much info either. And I guess the main acceptable real-world implication of this awkward period is, we Chinese value stability. We do not want chaotic change.
Well, in fact, they've and you've probably seen a good deal of this, they've taken the past, the Cultural Revolution, and they sort of turned it into nostalgia. So you get theme restaurants, you get bars, you get all kinds of fashions that sort of take off from this period, but it misses the nightmare of it.
Yeah. Yes, and so all I can say is that, as we journalists like to say, time will tell on how, as the generation who's been raised with no knowledge of this academically, but whose parents went through a lot of trauma. You know, the people who are today's university students, they were born in the early 80s. And so this was not part, you know, their first consciousness was of the era of the opening up of the job opportunities. What you're describing may also account for the fact that so few of the university students seem to have explicit ideas other than, I want to have a big car, and I want to have a big apartment, and I want to have a good job, a good paying job. maybe not that different from university students anywhere, but there's more rarely that overlay of I want to make China better in X, Y, and Z way, or I want to change this part of China.
And yet, you know, Jim, if you look at campuses in America now, you know, certainly at Berkeley, the hood ornament for dissent, if you look in Sproul Plaza, what you see is the campus crusade for Christ. You see, you know, you don't see political organizations working. How do you assess sort of the need for that side of life, the spiritual side of life, the valuative side of life, and what in your experience are people turning to in China when they want to figure out how do they relate to their wife? What's the proper relationship with a boss? How do you deport yourself with your children, your friends? What's the compass that...
You know, I will take this opportunity to plug another wonderful article in this issue by a young man named Adam Minter. And he has it's about the Catholic Church in Shanghai, about this bishop who's been in hiding for, you know, 40-odd, hiding / solitary confinement for a long time. And so thanks to Adam Minter, who's become a friend of ours, we spent a lot of time around the St. Ignatius Cathedral in Shanghai. And there is a kind of Catholic renaissance going on in China. You know, all statistics are guesses. You don't know if it's 5 million or 50 million people who are being caught up there. But the more evident sign of people looking for some kind of spiritual guidance is, of course, the often commented Confucian boom, where you do see university students reading diagnoses or analyses of the Analects, and there are courses in universities and there are TV shows all the time, these costume dramas about back in the day, and people had their relationships. So that's the main evidence I've been able to detect of a search for some kind of value, is saying, well, maybe there's a way to reprocess Confucius. In studies of the class I've been teaching at a leading university has been about U.S. foreign policy, I found surprisingly little interest in Western political models. Partly it's different from Europe, I think, where people are saying, what's happened to the U.S. political model right now that allows for this kind of imbalance of power? I think that's because from the mainstream Chinese point of view, last 5 or 6 years have been okay for them, because by concentrating on Iraq, the U.S. got off China's back. So it's been
sort of a paradox, isn't it, that our relationship with China improves when we stop paying attention.
And we attack somebody else, too.
Yeah. Listen, for those of you who haven't read Jim's article, there it is. Read it. Let me just cite a little scripture here and have you comment. Here's what Jim writes. It's a wonderful piece. The ultimate fear in the developed world, of course, is that China creates millions of new factory jobs. Unknown millions will lose such jobs in America, Canada, Germany, and even Japan. But these factories are both surprising and important in a less obvious, though also fundamental way. Almost nothing about the way they work corresponds to the way they are discussed in the U.S. America's political debates about the, quote, China opportunity, and even more, the China threat, seem distant, theoretical, imprecise, and from the perspective of the factories where the outsourcing and exporting occur. The industrialists from the United States, Europe, or Japan who are deciding how much of their production to move to China talk about the process in a very different terms from those used in the American political discussion. So there's a discontinuity here that you're alluding to. Talk a little about that.
You know, the real reward in journalism, and I would argue in life too, is finding things you didn't expect and just being surprised by the reality of life. And that was very much my experience. This is a picture of one of the loading docks in Shenzhen in southern China. And one of these containers that's shown on the cover comes to the U.S. one per second, 24 hours a day, every day of the year, and the rate is going up. They come back, they don't come, you know, I was asking what's in them when they come back. I thought the answer was going to be dollars, but it's not actually that. It's actually scrap paper. Scrap paper is the number one by volume export. Number two is scrap metal. A lot of them
isn't the richest person in China a woman who imports scrap paper here?
Scrap paper. And so I had thought that I basically understood the Chinese factory economy and that it wouldn't be that interesting to learn about it. But in fact, I spent a whole lot of time in factories. The time I have enjoyed most in China, Philistine that I am, is in these factories where they're making all kinds of stuff. Some of them are really horrible, as you've heard about in the slave labor scandal of the last 2 months, which has had tremendous traction, it seems to me, in China, where the actual Chinese press is on this in muckraking forms, even though the government has put out guidance that all discussion in online forums needs to be steered away from negative comments about party responsibility and instead towards more positive comments of what can be done to deal with the problem. But I came across a man who this is the other Mr. China, Orville being one. This is a man named Liam Casey. He's 41 years old. He's a high school graduate from Ireland. And he has put together the place in China where if you're a U.S. or European manufacturer and you have an idea, you can get it made by his factories in China faster and cheaper than any place else on the earth, including the Solio that many of you got in your, did many of you find that in your bag? This is something, a solar powered device to power this kind of handheld device. I saw that thing go through its whole evolution in Mr. China's factory. And what was interesting to me is both some of the mechanics, I guess I'll say three things were really interesting and I hadn't expected at all. One is the integration in a closed cycle sort of consumer way. I spent time in one of the factories where people in the U.S., probably including many of you, would click on the ordering website of a very, very famous American electronics company that's known for the high style of its products. It recently released, like in the last week, a new communications device. I was not allowed to say more than that, but I spent time where you order something from them, you click buy it now for an iPod or something, and in Shenzhen, there's a young woman sitting at a screen, your order pops up, your home address, she prints out a barcode label, there's this kind of production system of getting your exact order, and she works overnight, the DHL man comes at crack of dawn, he takes to the Hong Kong airport, and at max 48 hours after you click the button, the thing that was made in Shenzhen, you know, the moment you click the button, is at your house. And there's a kind of just integration which was surprising to me. Second, I was surprised by the young women themselves, that these electronic factories and workers are overwhelmingly women in their 20s who have come from the provinces, and they work there for 3 or 4 years. They net about $100 a month, but they can save most of it. They live in these crowded dormitories, eat 3 meals a day, and then they can go home after 3 or 4 years with some money. I guess another thing that surprised me was there'll be two more, and these are all sort of culminating to this, what it means for America. How wide was the variation of automation and modernity in these factories? There are some factories, and I think I have a picture here, which are very high-tech. The laptop computers we all use by different brand names, whether they're Apple or IBM or Lenovo or ThinkPad, they're essentially all made by 5 Taiwanese firms in southern China, and those factories are quite advanced. They have all these pick-and-place devices for putting on the components. Most other ones I've seen are quite non-mechanized. This pan, no doubt, was made in China, and I haven't seen the literal woman, but I can imagine the woman who snaps on this part right here every 2 seconds, for a 12-hour shift. And it's because partly it's cheap, you can do that, but partly you don't have to invest in the capital equipment. You can change the whole working place. And those jobs are not going to come to the U.S. because nobody would do them in the U.S. A machine would do them. This leads to the related surprise of these factories, which is most of the political discourse I read in the U.S. about dealing with China involves the value of the RMB, which seems to me just completely beyond the point in most Chinese places. I cost out in this article a lot of leading Chinese products. You could take, say, a pair of Ethernet cables, very high-end ones that might retail for $29.95 in specialty stores in the U.S. The all-inclusive price from China of those cables is $2, and all the rest is sort of processing, branding, everything else. So suppose the RMB doubled in value. They would cost $4, which is still a little share of the $29.95 they're going for in the U.S. And so I'm thinking, save your time talking about the RMB and spend more time thinking how to keep the U.S. on the high end of the technology production level. You didn't ask that, but that's my little speech.
Well, of course, all of this
production uses an enormous amount of resources. And let's turn for a minute to the environment, because it seems to me that there are many flexible edges of this developmental envelope, but the environment is one which is really absolutely inflexible. How do you assess where China is in terms of coming to the brick wall that ultimately will constrain them in their economic growth, if nothing else?
You know, this, again, we were mentioning earlier things that were surprising. Everybody here knows that China has an environment problem. In my experience, everybody who actually then goes and spends a couple of days, especially in Beijing in the summer, simply can't believe it. James Bennett is in the room, my editor of The Atlantic. Were he not to be the editor of The Atlantic, he was going to go with his family and small children to Beijing as a correspondent for The New York Times. I feel as if I have saved his children from being stunted in growth.
Mine are there right now, Jim.
They already have some size on them. Shanghai is much less burdensomely polluted than Beijing. The first 3 weeks we were in Shanghai, we thought, what's the problem? You know, the sky looks almost like this. We discovered that the reason was a huge belt of typhoons in southern China. They were killing millions, killing thousands of people, but they kept the airflow fresh so that the air was okay in Shanghai for a while last summer. But it's the environmental situation, I think, is as you know, just a disaster, and is reported that way increasingly in the Chinese press. And the question is what they can do about it. The limiting factors being these, the coal-fired electric plants are, of course, coming on now two a week or three every 2 weeks.
And 70% of all China's power comes from coal.
Yes. And it's interesting to engage Chinese officials in this, because they say, okay, you like these products we make, we need electricity for those factories. We use some tiny fraction of the electricity you do. I don't know what it is, it's a very, very small fraction. You want us to sit in the dark, but you want to have your air conditioners on? Well, that's not fair. You don't want us to use coal? Okay, how about more nuclear? Now, how about if we make another Three Gorges Dam? Mm-hmm. How about if we get more oil from Darfur? You know, there is not a great range of pleasant alternatives, and I think that they have a case in saying they are wrong in sort of saying we're a developing country, you can't blame us for anything, but right in saying this is a big world problem, which I think the U.S. with its technology needs to find some way to work out with the Chinese. The water situation is significant. I was, the first week we were there, I was the sickest I've been in my entire life. And I think it's because I had a little drop of water unintentionally. I think Deb and I, like many foreigners, sort of feel bad all the time, as I think many Chinese do too. And I think there is a condition, most people in China don't realize how bad the burden actually is, because they haven't lived elsewhere, but it's significant.
Well, recently I had occasion to drive from Beijing down to the Yellow River, which is just short of 300 miles, to where my wife had grown up. And there are many legendary rivers that you cross on this absolutely beautiful highway, and you've surely traveled on these, that make American freeways look really retrograde. But the interesting fact was, although we crossed maybe 10, 12 rivers, there was not a drop of water in a single river. And when you got to the Yellow River, of course, the Yellow River now doesn't even debouch out into the ocean in the lower reaches, because all the water is taken out of it for irrigation or whatever. This strikes me as the kind of resource constriction that's going to really have dire consequences for China's ability to keep developing.
Yes, I would agree. And we were talking earlier about how long can go, and you can think of all the various limiting factors. To my mind, environmental ones are the most likely, and the ones that would sort of ripple with other social effects too, because I think people are sensing that it's not simply bad economically, and it is that, but it's just bad in life as well. So there was a related point I was going to make, but I will save it for later when I think of it again.
Well, one other, while you're thinking, one other factoid which just when I contemplated it, it's so alarming, and it is this. that 7% of the glacial ice mass on the Tibetan Plateau is now melting each year. Now, if you think of all the great rivers of Asia, whose headwaters are on the Tibetan Plateau, you suddenly realize that if the actuarial table on the ice mass of the Tibetan Plateau is whatever, 10, 12, maybe 15 years, what's going to happen to every river in Asia when that's all accomplished?
And yes, and the one implication of that would be as Americans talk more, as I think they should, about their relationship with China, which is always referred to in China as, you know, the U.S.-Chinese relationship is the one they want to cultivate. It's the most important axis for them, and I think that's actually true. The U.S. should spend much less time talking about the RMB, in my view. It should spend way, way less time talking about the threat of the People's Liberation Army, as we can get into later if you want. In my view, this is way exaggerated, and much more talking about the way in which China actually can be the swing factor in the whole world getting destroyed or not, which is the environmental effects of their inevitable growth. Now, it's 1.2 billion people who are going to have electricity, and they're going to have drinking water. Somebody told me in Shanghai when we first got there that if the average person in Shanghai took even one shower per week, you know, they'd have no water. It's just that it's because the average level of showering is like, you know, once per 2 months or something. And people are going to take showers, and they're going, you know, these things are going to happen. And so I think the U.S., what would look good in retrospect would be as if the U.S. had this as the main strategic engagement with China. How can we help them not kill themselves and everybody else too?
Okay, let's talk about that, because it seems to me this gets down to the heart of the matter. We take the economic miracle, we are in awe that it's by and large a good thing for China, bringing more people out of poverty, has many dilemmas. But if we turn back to our country, how do you, when you're sitting in Shanghai, if you could wave a wand, what elements of American policy would you change? What would you have the United States do to reassert a leadership role, to get the relationship right, to save the Chinese, to save us, the whole menu?
That's a very interesting question. So if I'm putting aside, so just from their point of view, of course, number one would be at all times paying obeisance to the theory of national unification, and never giving any weapons to the government on Taiwan, of saying that, of course, you know, having the Taiwan issue be served up exactly the way the Chinese want. That would be number one. Number two, being supportive and understanding of the Chinese regime, and it's you have to break eggs to make an omelet approach to sometimes you got to clear people out of their house, sometimes you got to arrest them, you know, to move forward. I'm not saying this is my perspective, I'm saying from the Chinese point of view. On a more agreeable or possibly agreeable situation, it would be the U.S. recognizing that China's fate really does matter to everybody, most of the Chinese, but to its neighbors, everybody else, and that its fate should be viewed as its growth should be viewed as a basically positive phenomenon. The rare rise of powers that doesn't immediately threaten other powers, doesn't immediately threaten the U.S. in any direct way, that we're in partnership, we can deal with the areas which are most important. So I would have, I guess, the two elements of my first day's announcement would be increasing the student and H-1B visas for Chinese people to the U.S., and having all sorts of high-level collaboration on tech solutions to the coal-fired plant problem and all these other things. That's where the U.S. has things they don't, of technological ways to deal with these environmental constraints. And I think that's a worthy sort of Sputnik-type project from our point of view. In the minor reason is keeping China friendly and a partner. The major reason is avoiding catastrophe.
Yeah, and the truth is, the old definition of sort of foreign aid is you save the benighted foreigner. The new definition is you save yourself. Because we're all in this together if you have an environmental agenda.
You know, it's really interesting when it comes to saving the benighted local foreigner. The Chinese have actually done a phenomenal job of that through these factories. The people who work in the factories are peasants by and large. And while some of the factories are terrible, a lot of them aren't. And there's been a huge, you know, conveyor belt for a lot of people out of poverty.
Yeah, it's interesting to note that these factory workers and the construction workers, all of the peasants who've come in from the countryside, nobody knows how many they are, 150 million, but whatever number you ascribe to this movement, it is the largest migration in human history, but it's an internal migration, so we lose track of it.
And can I interrupt there for one other point? The contrast with India is really interesting. You know, China and India are different sort of in all ways, but the people who've benefited from the globalization boom in India are mainly college graduates, and it's a very small number. It's, you know, a million or two versus many tens of millions, and that's a huge contrast.
Now, Jim, you have been at least peripherally involved in the beginnings, middles, or ends of several other bubbles. Now, you were in Japan in the 80s, and you wrote a book, Looking at the Sun, as I recall. You were also did a stint at Microsoft. I guess it was shortly after Silicon Valley went off the rails.
No, it was right on the crest.
Right on the, good for you, right on the crest. And then you also spent some time in Malaysia before the Southeast Asia crack up. But you've at least had some acquaintance with bubbles. Now, let's talk about bubbles in China.
Certainly there are bubble aspects to what's going on in China. I have, to me, the moment when my heart really sank is I have a young graduate student assistant at one of the local universities, not Fudan, who does translation help for me. And I say, you know, can you tell me what this blog discourse is saying? And so he is a person whose own family, he said the reason they didn't suffer in Shanghai in the Cultural Revolution is they had no education, they were just factory workers, and so they were on the good side of the prestige curve. He's a very nice and serious young man. He wants sometimes to come to the U.S. His dissertation for his doctorate right now is about Paul Wolfowitz. You know, go figure. So we have much to talk about. But about a month ago, I was having a beer with him to discuss some project I was doing, and he said that he and his mother had started putting money into the Shanghai Stock Exchange.
Uh-oh.
And you know, when you have the Shanghai Stock Exchange has like tripled in the last year or something, it's just gotten to these preposterous heights. And when you start having, I said, what are you talking about? You know, the PE ratio on these stocks is you know, many, many times higher than any place in the rest of the world. And he immediately said, this graduate student from a worker family said, oh yes, but that's not the moving average of the PE. In fact, if you take the last quarter of the PE, it supports these PE values and all the rest. So you have the classic bubble phenomenon of everybody putting their money in.
And borrowing money from banks to put into
exactly.
the stock market.
So you have the stock market, you have the banks. You have a lot of sort of bubble sort of behavior in high-end restaurants. And I did a story in The Atlantic about a guy who has his own sort of Hearst Castle out in Changsha with his own Palace of Versailles, the Pyramid of Egypt, an Air Force of several planes by himself. So there's a lot of top-of-market behavior. But you get the feeling that there is underneath it something chugging along, too, that it's... The counter-argument to this is that China depends so heavily on exports that a serious world downturn would hurt them, but hurt everybody else, too. So there is a bubble, but one sense is there's something below the bubble, too.
Now we were talking yesterday, and actually Du Weiming and Rod McFarquhar had a session in which their conclusion was that inevitably, in order for China, the government, to become more legitimate, it must democratize. We were ruminating yesterday on the possibility that maybe what you see is what you get in China. Maybe they're there. Maybe their development model is sort of complete, and we have a kind of a Leninist capitalism. How do you imagine this?
I was fascinated to hear the conversation yesterday afternoon because, unlike either of the two people who were speaking, I am not a professor of Chinese studies at Harvard, so I don't have that. That background to bring to it. However, you know, having watched, I remember when I was living in Japan 20 plus years ago, the argument was Japan inevitably had to open up and westernize in order to keep going. And it turns out, yes, they had to do that to keep going, and they chose not to do it. They chose instead to kind of keep this closed model with all the 15 years worth of consequence, and the LDP is still in power, and there still is all the sort of structural elements of past Japan. With China, there is a logical argument that to keep going, it will have to lighten the hand of the state and give people more control, and maybe so. But it seems to me also maybe not. You know, and you can look at the effects of prosperity as illustrating this, that perhaps as people become more prosperous, they demand more rights, but perhaps as people become more prosperous, they don't care about the other rights.
You've got a conservative middle class that says, good enough,
exactly.
Let's not rock the boat.
And so what this means for U.S. policy, in my view, and I think is related to what you're saying, is what we see is what we get, is you set aside any arguments or assumptions about the direction in which it's going. You say, this is the country we're dealing with now. It has parts of it that are opening up. It has parts of it that are controlled, and that's the package we're dealing with. We'll criticize the stuff we don't like, you know, the repression and all the rest. We'll work with the parts that we can. If it changes, great. But for now, we'll deal with what we see.
Mm-hmm. You know, one interesting sort of aspect of this, whatever is happening in China, this incredible transition, change, is civil society. And it certainly is growing. And yet, as of the present, still has no real legal basis for existence. So it's sort of hovering. Yeah. In the middle of nowhere, and yet it's becoming more and more robust. How do you imagine that will work out in the future?
There's an interesting dilemma here where the number of NGOs, there's a very, very low ceiling by the Chinese government on how many NGOs can operate. There's sort of one per category in the country. But the main civil society counterpart is the internet-based groups. You know, my wife Deb works for the Pew Internet Project, and she deals all the time with these blogging groups in China. And so you have these informal civil society sort of spring up. Now, it's true that most internet activity in China is playing games and instant messaging, but there's still, you see these communities that take some route that way, and that's the main growth I have detected in civil society, one that's facilitated by the internet.
And you think, the Chinese have actually done a pretty good job to date in controlling the internet, haven't they?
I would say yes and no. Yes, in that, you know, there's all sorts of websites you simply can't get to unless you have a VPN to get around the firewall. Technorati is always blocked in the main site. Google is blocked sometimes. BBC is almost always blocked. Sometimes my Atlantic site is blocked, sometimes not. So yes, there's...
How about this article?
This article, Why China's Rise is Good for Us. Somehow, I don't imagine they're going to be, you know, putting the kibosh on that. but who knows? One day it was blocked. I was, you know, the title of this article inside is China Makes, the World Takes, and I had a blog item on my own blog talking about the Trenton precedent for that. You know, the famous bridge in Trenton. Trenton makes, the world takes. For some reason, they blocked that. And maybe they thought that Trenton's industrial ruin too much prefigured what was going to happen to them. But it's also true, so there's a huge nuisance factor they can impose, but number one, you can get around it pretty easily with these VPNs, and number two, if you're 95% effective in blocking incoming news, the remaining 5% can sort of repropagate itself very quickly.
But still, it's of consequence that 95% of people my experience in the internet there is that you don't always know what it is that's happening.
Yeah.
So you may be blocked and you don't really know. Right. You think you're messing up. You think you didn't do it right. It's not explained.
You know, there's a fascinating technical explanation for this. I have some friends at Google who I was interviewing about why exactly their site times out when it does away here 10 times longer than normal, and it effectively blocks the site.
How do you think views of the United States and China have changed over the last few years? With us not paying so much attention, has it helped, or what's the view of
that? That's interesting. First, I'll say that of all the countries I've been in the last 5 years, China is the least anti-American, which is surprising. I think because Iraq is not big on the radar screen, so that's one factor. Second, it's amazing how often there is volunteered the positive effects that the U.S. has had through World War II, through visas, through all this, and so I find, you know, more sort of respectful than unrespectful, but still, I don't have to tell anybody in this room the compromise of moral standing the U.S. has gone through in the last 5 years is almost bottomless or limitless. And whenever the U.S. releases a human rights criticism of the China, now that the foreign ministry comes out with a paper whose running headline is, "What about Guantanamo?" You know, and so they say, you know, you clean up your own house before you come whining to us, basically.
What topics do you have on your screen for future investigation?
I have one that's now in the pipeline, still just having fact checks. It's a morality play. It's one of the many chapters of the collision between Chinese values and universal values, and the vector, the avatar of universal values in this case, the one standing in the realm of, you know, Locke and Thomas Paine, everybody else, is the Nevada Gaming Commission. And the Nevada Gaming Commission is locked in a struggle of human rights involving the city of Macau and with the Chinese authorities, and that's interesting to me. And I'm spending a lot of time trying to learn more about the Confucian Renaissance and trying to find more what China's going to do with all these trillions of dollars of U.S. cash that it has sitting around, how it will affect us, and some other just stories of people who are trying to change how things work in China. So that's what I'm up to at the moment.
And what do you think China will do with its trillion plus in foreign reserves?
Boy, if I knew,
give it to Blackstone.
that's actually seen in China as a very, very shrewd thing for them to do, yeah. Of sort of strategic investment without seeming heavy-handed the way the Japanese did. So if you have a theory on this, I should perhaps interview you off stage so I can get guidance for my article.
I think we all have lots of questions and few answers. Yeah. Now, that raises the prospect of you all. I'm sure you all have many questions. But how much time do we have left here? Who's running this event? All right, let's try two quick questions. All right, you. Hang on to the mic because this is on the air. Quickly tell us who you are.
I mean, that's a fascinating question.
And everyone's asking.
Everyone is asking that because, you know, the pollution is, I grew up in L.A. in the 50s and 60s, and the pollution is worse than anything I've seen, you know, any of us has seen in our lifetime, pollution in Beijing. I guess the argument, I am shocked by how important the Olympics are to China. You know, this is the real sort of, you know, this is the international legitimization. And you see posters every place, you know, civilized nations, civilized Olympics, civilized Qingdao welcomes a civilized Olympics where they have the events. And one assumes that they will do everything necessary to clean up the air, banning all the cars, banning all the factories. And the question is whether that's enough. And nobody knows the answers. I think all foreigners are skeptical, but we'll see.
I would have to say they're doing an incredible job, the air quality notwithstanding.
Well, but that's a big, you know.
That's
apart from that, Mrs. Lincoln.
It's I mean, the Olympic Park is extraordinary, yeah. And they have got the whole city turned upside down, and it's quite astounding. All right, we have time maybe for one more question over here.
Yes, very quickly. What are some of the lessons from African countries that you can apply?
All right, lessons for African countries. You know, China is placing a huge emphasis right now on its bond with Africa, and there was the African summit in November in Beijing, where actually the air was clear. You know, it was November, but it was clear. I think there, so few things are applicable in the scale of China to Africa. So I think it would be hard to impose the Chinese model in general. But I would imagine when they talk, they would say, we show the sequence between democratization and industrial development. That if you do industrial development, then you can wait for democratization. And so I imagine that is the lesson they would preach. I'm sure there's a lot of incidental ways, especially about trying to bring low-wage manufacturing and all the rest. I think the lessons are hard to transfer because of scale differences and historical differences, but probably the ones they would preach involve the balance between political rights and economic development.
And of course, the whole question of Darfur,
yes,
and the rebranded Olympics as the Genocide Olympics is causing tremendous consternation,
yes,
in China. And it remains to be seen how that works out. Well, I think we have to end here. So join me in thanking Jim Fallis.
Thank you, Robert.